I'd first like to thank Asia House for inviting me, and actually Pamela for persuading me to commit to being in London at this time, and to give this talk. It has been a good excuse for me to think about a few issues and ideas that have been circling around in my mind over the past several years. And I have to say, I don't have any conclusions for some of the issues that I will bring up, but I think it's something that we all need to reflect about. Many of you must be working in the art world or involved in cultural exchange in one form or another, or you wouldn't be here, I think. So for the next 40 minutes or so, I'll offer some of my thoughts about the changes I've seen over the years, and looking at how art from elsewhere is seen and presented, and reflecting on how we can understand and assess what is actually achieved by the kind of work that we do. I'd like to apologize in advance. I have a bit of an allergic reaction to something tonight, so my throat's quite scratchy, and earlier there was a bit of a crash with my computer, so I had to quickly throw back together my PowerPoint, and I've lost many of my notes, so you'll have to bear with me. So as you know, I'm actually director of international programs for the Sharjah Art Foundation, where I've worked for the past 8 years. And like many people who work in the art world, artists, art professionals from nonprofits, for-profits, journalists, academics, etc., I find that traveling is an absolute necessity to my work. And not just in my case, in terms of me moving from my home in London out to my office in Sharjah, but to travel to other places to either see art being produced in other cities or to meet with people with whom I'll work on projects. Most of us who have this type of work situation complain endlessly about how much we have to travel or how we can't get to see some of the things that we really wish we could see or that we think we should be seeing. So there's constantly this guilt about, oh gosh, I'm going to miss the opening of the Sao Paulo Biennale. Maybe I'll be able to get back, you know, to see the closing ceremony. Of course, half the time you don't get there. But this is this endless kind of struggle to try to keep up and to stay informed and to be someone who actually is engaged with what is happening around the world. But at the same time, we're always, those of us who are involved in this world, complain about the proliferation of biennials, triennials, art fairs, auctions, new institutions, and new art initiatives around the world. How should we really think about this activity? Is this a good thing? Is it a bad thing? Is it market-driven? Is it driven by the need of different art centers to find a voice? I think now there's this continual debate about actually what constitutes the art world and what is important and how those of us who are involved, particularly in the nonprofit part of that, should think about how this world has developed. And I suppose this talk has given me an opportunity to look back and to think about actually what has changed since the time when I was working in Japan in the 1980s. And that was an interesting time because I don't know if some of you must remember, what was happening in 1980? Did any of you know about Japan? What was going on in the contemporary art world of Japan? Most people didn't know. When I moved to Japan, people sent me care packages to Tokyo. It was a time when the Walkman first came into popularity. I think it was developed about 1979. And it was probably about 1983 that all of a sudden journalists from everywhere were coming out trying to cover Japanese contemporary culture. It was the Japanese miracle. And it was really interesting and quite obvious to watch how art followed that miracle. And you think about, I mean, now looking back from today where we are to back then, I think that was kind of the first big international art boom in a center. But over the next 30 years, the shifts in global economic and cultural influences have resulted in the rise of new art centers around the world. So we've seen the same thing happen across the Middle East, the Far East. You see Istanbul emerging as a major art center, the UAE. You have all sorts of new contemporary art developments in Mumbai and in Shanghai, so much activity. Korea is you know, an amazing center now for arts. You have the Kochi Biennial, you have the Dhaka Art Summit. There's just everywhere something new is happening. So from a personal perspective, I've watched these developments from my time in Japan to the present. My work has always been deeply informed by a belief in the power of art and culture to communicate and a curiosity about the world that I don't know. Still, in this context, I find it really difficult to understand how slow the Western art establishment has been to embrace the reality of this world and this shift that has taken place. Recently, I returned from the opening of the 56th Venice Biennale, which I don't know if many of you, did many of you go to that? The curator was the distinguished Nigerian Okwi Enwizor, and the exhibition this year was titled All the World's Future. This was a biennale that was severely political in its stance, and its insistence on challenging, or in fact, I feel, demonstrating, that the colonial Western-focused bias in the art world was no longer tenable. About half of the artists in the exhibition, for the first time, were from outside of Western Europe and North America. This was something that most people remarked upon. So this year, it was remarkable to people that you had an originally Nigerian curator, probably the first African curator to curate such a major exhibition, although he did document previously. And you have an exhibition that is remarkable for the fact that it has such a wide range of basically non-white artists. So here we are in 2015. At the same time, what was it, a month or so ago, that in the art newspaper there was an article that released a study they had done where they said, and I'm quoting here, nearly one-third of the major solo exhibitions held in U.S. museums between 2007 and 2013 featured artists represented by just five galleries. This is according to research by the art newspaper. They analyzed nearly 600 exhibitions submitted by 68 museums for an annual attendance figure survey and found that 30% of the prominent solo shows featured artists represented by Gagosian Gallery, Pace Gallery, Marion Goodman Gallery, David Zirmer, and Hauser & Wirth. So you have this situation where, on the one hand, America is still presenting exhibitions totally dominated by this very traditional art world establishment, and people being surprised that in Venice, this exhibition is doing exactly the opposite. That's not to say that institutions around the world aren't trying to address or redress these issues of this dominant Western-centric viewpoint, but it is surprising to me how slowly and how little things have actually changed over the past 30 years. And I think I remember, and I'll show some slides in a moment, that even in the early 80s in Japan, artists were objecting to being ghettoized as Japanese artists and being sent around and just curated into shows that were all about the new Japan or this and this Japan. So that was in the 80s. But it's still happening today, now a lot with Middle Eastern artists, for example. So this is something that I think it's interesting how far we have not moved from something that was problematic already that long ago. So I'd like to just review a little bit of some of the things that I've personally seen and some of the changes that have, or the changes of the developments, or some of the milestones in a way of the past few years, well, since 1980 actually, I'm saying. So this was one of, I think, and you know, I haven't done a huge academic study on this, but this is one of the first major exhibitions that I remember taking place in the 80s that focused on Japan, contemporary Japan. So this was curated by Martin and Mickey Friedman of the Walker Art Center, and it was a hugely ambitious exhibition that paired architects with artists in an attempt to grapple with the apparent contradictions of old and new Tokyo. It was interesting that in the New York Magazine, a review of the show, which was rather critical, called it a show by Westerners for Westerners. The writer said, in spite of its billing as an art exhibition, what it really means to do is ask the question that continues to befuddle Americans, what exactly is modern Japan? The implication being, why is it so much better at some things than we are? Now, that was 1986. The people were still befuddled by Tokyo. It's not that long ago. How is it that in that period of time, people were so mystified? So exhibitions like this were an attempt to, you know, reveal to people what Japan was like, what it really felt like, but it was seen as a show by Westerners for Westerners. In 1989, there was Against Nature, which was a show curated by, Kathy Halbright was one of the main curators at MIT. The Museum of Fine Arts Boston was involved, the Gray Art Gallery, Shinji Kimoto from the National Museum of Modern Art, Kyoto, and Fumio Nanjo were among the curators. This show attempted to, I don't know if you know, any of you know the Japanese artist. This is Yasumasa Morimura. I can't really tell who that is in the back. Shinro Otake, who was in the last Venice Biennale. I'm not entirely sure who this is on the side. I was unable to get a copy of this publication. And there was absolutely, this is the other thing that's quite interesting, no records of really, full records of this exhibition exist, except if you can buy the catalog. I actually have the catalog, but it's in storage, so because I've moved house. But I could not find that information, which is also true of the Tokyo Forum of Spirit. People don't keep that information on their websites like they do now. So this is another interesting thing: how websites are actually going to be affecting what people remember and what they know about the art that's being produced today. So that was something that was interesting to me as I was trying to go back and collect some of this information. So Against Nature, the curatorial premise said, this exhibition constructs a view of the tensions informing Japanese art today. After World War II, Japanese economic and social values changed rapidly, so did aesthetic concerns. As conventional social structures collapsed, design became democratized. Today, one block of downtown Tokyo jams together the kitsch aesthetic, the microchip, the Shinto shrine. The traditional nature worship of Japanese aesthetics and philosophy has given way to modern-day developers. So their theory is that the young artists are confronting this tradition with this new art. Here's the Hara Museum where mentioned that I was, Pamela mentioned I was working, along with Primal Spirit, which took exactly the opposite stance to the Against Nature. So where the curator said, the artists included in Against Nature attack outdated views, both foreign and domestic, of Japan and its artistic heritage as rooted in the soil of an agrarian land. A Primal Spirit did just exactly the opposite and proposed an exhibition that explored the direction in Japanese art today that is unique in contemporary art internationally. The artists share a belief that man is integral with nature and that the work of art is the locus of the artist's spiritual encounter with natural forces. So you have yet another approach, an attempt to demystify this country that was already so advanced in terms of, you know, technology and I don't know, did anyone see a monopole recently? Tokyo came out as the top most livable city in the world, which is quite interesting. So this show was organized by the Hara Museum and the Los Angeles County Museum and curated by Howard Fox, and it toured America. Here's an example of some of the artworks. Kazuo Kenmochi and Kimio Tsuchiya and Fuji, I forget his first name. Chuichi Fuji, massive works. So then you have in 1991 in Liverpool, A Cabinet of Signs. This exhibition was interesting because it was originally called My Bag of Thrills. And when Hiroshi Sugimoto threatened to withdraw because of the title, thinking it was really not a very nice way to talk about the contemporary art to say, you know, it's just a bunch of thrills. It seemed like such a throwaway title. They renamed it the Cabinet of Signs. The artists in the show were Hiroshi Sugimoto, Emiko Kasahara, Tatsuya Miyajima, Shinro Otake, Yasumasa Morimura, and Hitoshi Nomura. So by 1991, yeah, so here's Yasumasa Morimura's commission, actually. It's called The Woman with the Fan, and you can see that's himself copying a famous portrait with his own adaptations. And here's his version of Angels Descending a Staircase. This is a massive work. So it went to Tate Liverpool, the Whitechapel, and I don't remember where else it toured. So by the 1990s, as the Japanese miracle came to a close, and I should say that during that time in Japan, when I was working, it was really noticeable how masses of curators from the West would come out trying to stake their claim to certain sections of the contemporary art world. And people would try to stake their claim to certain kinds of funders to fund and support things. So it's a question that I see still today is our institutions and are these projects, what's pushing what? Is it an economic imperative? You know, is it the ability to get money to fund something that drives people to do it? I mean, if Japan hadn't been such an economic miracle and there couldn't be people funding these kind of big extravagant exhibitions, would they have happened on the kind of scale that they happened? And was that the right way for people to learn about Japan at that time? Anyway, it's questions that I have. You know, how do we look at these kind of exhibitions that we see happening today as well? Exhibitions that just focus on one particular country, one particular curatorial viewpoint, massing together different artists for a very short period of time. Anyway, so as the economic miracle in Japan concluded, funding dried up, people were less interested in working with Japan. And, you know, I don't have a full history of what happened after that, but what I do know is that a lot of attention then turned to China. So China was the next big thing. And all the curators I knew were not going to Japan anymore, they were all going to China. So you have this series of exhibitions about Chinese art, and people investing in Chinese art, just this whole big machine happening. But at the same time, there was also the whole issue of re-examining the Western-centric perspective of art history. This is from an important exhibition called Le Magicien de la Terre, curated by Jean-Paul Martin for the Palais de Tokyo, which was quite a controversial exhibition, but it attempted to basically readdress the problem that 100% of the exhibitions ignore 80% of the artists around the world. So he tried to put an equal balance between Western and non-Western art, and this is one of the really first times that was done on a large scale. And even though a lot of people objected to how he did it, what did happen is that it stirred a controversy and discussion and made people really rethink how we look at this art and how people curate it. So then China. This was from the Venice Biennale. You know, all of a sudden everyone wanted to know about the Chinese pop, the political art. There were big exhibitions around the world for different art of that kind, art that kind of appealed to Western sensibilities, that reflected maybe a more Western sense of what really makes good contemporary art. So that was the Venice Biennale in 1993. I have never been a specialist in Chinese art, so I can't tell you about so many of the different exhibitions. But you do have for example, I did a minor timeline. About 1993 is when a lot of, say, for example, the Asia-Pacific Triennial began introducing a lot of Chinese art. There was the first, in 95, the Guangzhou Biennale, 96, the Shanghai Biennale, 98, Inside Out, New Chinese Art at the Asia Society, went to San Francisco MoMA. And then about 2002, apparently the first commercial gallery opened in Beijing. So that whole decade was kind of a very Chinese moment, I think. And on a personal level, I was living in London by that point, by 1993. But I kept finding people who were talking about investing in Chinese art. Now, I don't ever remember people saying, oh, we're going to invest in Japanese art. But it was a kind of moment where all of a sudden the economy began to be very tied to these notions of exploring other alternative art worlds. And at about the same time, there was a Christie's auction. When was that? There was a... it wasn't until 2008 when there was a Christie's auction in Hong Kong that really set records. But certainly by the late 90s and early 2000s, people I knew were talking about investing and getting in on the ground level for Chinese art. About the same time, that whole notion of traveling around and exploring these alternative art worlds really began to be something that was a done thing. So Latin America, India, Far East, Middle East has become probably about the 2006 was the first Christie's auction in Dubai. And that was another moment where all of a sudden people started thinking about Middle Eastern art as investment. There was very little writing about contemporary Middle Eastern art. And when I started, when I first went out, which was 2007, often it was only the auction house catalogs that people had that had any record of an artist's production. Because there were so few galleries, there must have been about three galleries at that time in Dubai. There were some galleries in Cairo and in Beirut, a bit in Kuwait and Bahrain, but not a lot of documentation, which remains an issue for many people. And a lot of artists these days end up working with the idea of re-archiving and rediscovering what has been lost. But in Dubai, that auction generated a huge amount of Western interest that was then further developed through Art Dubai, which was the next year. So at the same time, you know, the first Sharjah Biennial happened in 1993, but nobody really knew about that kind of development. Nobody knew about all of these little initiatives taking place. I can't remember when Townhouse Cairo started. Do you know? Yeah.
Early.
In the 80s, yeah. So there were these other things that happened, but one has to question, what is it that really made people in the West suddenly pay attention to what was happening? I remember coming back after the first Art Dubai, and I tried to find this article, and I couldn't. As I said, most of my files and everything are still in storage, but there was an article by someone, I think, for The Guardian, or Independent, who wrote this review of Art Dubai about things like, and they walked away, the sheikh walked away like a line of linen flapping in the wind. And the only real thing were the women with their hennaed hands sitting by the old boats down by the, it was just so kind of bigoted coverage, and it was all about why do they think they can have our culture? I mean, it was really quite shocking. That was 2007. You know, that was when Saadiyat Island was announced, when all of a sudden the French were all upset because the Louvre was selling their patrimony and you know, the Guggenheim was going to be invading the Middle East and franchising, you know, American-style cultural imperialism. So it's, I suppose it's interesting to see that how powerful the economic influence of the market has been on people's perception of what is happening where. So even though there were artists who were working long and doing good work and making interesting statements, nobody knew about it, really, except people out in the Middle East. So the, and I suppose, if one looks at, say, for example, the Sharjah Biennial, it wasn't until about 2003 that it became a more documenta-based, more so curatorial type of biennial. And so maybe over time, that it took that much time to become public and become sort of something that people in the West could understand. I don't do any, how many of you know about the Sharjah Biennial? You, of course, Tilly. But, so I'll just tell you a little bit about Sharjah. So this is actually the Sharjah Art Foundation new art spaces in the middle of Sharjah City. Sharjah is one of the seven UAE Emirates. It's about a 20-minute cab ride from Dubai Airport. I still have to tell people that it's next to Dubai. About 5 years ago, no, even less, 4 years ago, I was on a bus with a bunch of really important American art critics in Abu Dhabi, talking about what I did. And one really important, I won't mention the name, one really important editor said, oh, I knew there was a Sharjah Biennial, but I had no idea there was a place called Sharjah. So I mean, this is just extraordinary that, you know, why do people know Dubai? They know it because it's an art fair, and they know Abu Dhabi because there are these planned museums that still haven't been built. So anyway, and they know Doha because Sheikha Mayasa has spent more money than anyone in the world, so she is the most, or at least a couple years ago, was considered the most powerful person in the art world by Art Review. So this was the Sharjah Biennial in 8th Sharjah Biennial 2007, sorry. You see work there by Mona Hatoum. This is from the next Sharjah Biennial. This is work by Hala Al-Kusi. Red palms, nails, and let me get the perfect title for that. Which I don't seem to have on this list. This is actually now in the Tate collection. So as I said, my notes all got lost. So this was in 2007, 2009, on red nails, palm trees, and other icons. So what does happen, you know, when you have all of these, as much as people complain about why is it necessary to have biennials and triennials around the world, all of the big Western curators will come out to Sharjah to see what's happening there because they don't have any other way to be exposed to it. Same thing happens going to Sao Paulo. If you want to know about Latin American art, you have to go there because there's so little representation outside of those places. So these kind of events become not only a place where people go to see art, but also a place where they go to meet their colleagues. And, you know, curators will come and they'll meet an artist they've never met before, and that will lead to them having an exhibition somewhere else. So as much as people complain or question the necessity of the development of all these kind of artwork events around the world, it is still something that has had a kind of a genuinely important effect for the artists and for especially smaller institutions, I think. This was a work by Imran Qureshi that was from the 2010 biennial. This biennial 10 in 2009 and biennial 11 in 2000, so I get them all confused. This was a really beautiful work that it's in the middle of a courtyard, and you look down, it looks a bit like a bloodbath. But it's all hand-painted, beautifully hand-painted flowers. I mean, this was the most extraordinary work. And it's titled Blessings Upon the Land of My Love. So it's a lot about the sort of violence in Pakistan, and you know, he's a teacher at the Lahore University. But because we did this, then people like Sheena Wagstaff, who's now has this impossible title of something like chairperson of something or something of contemporary art, it's like a two-line title, at the Met in New York. And she got him to do a terrace. So his work then became very exposed in New York. It was also in the Sydney Biennial. Here is Sheikh Sultan Mohammed bint al-Qasimi with his daughter, Sheikha Hur, and Yuko Hasegawa, who was the curator for the 2013 Sharjah Biennial 11. So whereas it's remarkable that someplace like, you know, in Venice, for the Venice Biennale, that in this day and age, half of the artists are not from North America and Latin America. In other parts of the world, it's kind of surprising if there's a third of the artists who are from North America or Latin America. And I think when I was in Japan, I would say that people, the artists always felt they had to go to New York to make it. It was really very much that New York was where you had to be or be shown or be seen in order to be successful. And Nicholas, you might disagree with me, but I don't think that's true anymore. You know, I think that for a lot of artists, most of the artists I know, they'd rather be in Europe, they'd rather be in London or in Paris. You think it's true as well? So the sort of some of the commercial galleries here. You know, it's there's definitely a shift in how people perceive whose opinions are important. And, you know, I think certainly for the Middle East, a lot of artists that I know can't even really travel to America anymore. They have a really hard time getting their visas, they feel uncomfortable, they don't like the way they're treated. So, again, when you're thinking about how is it that there are shifts in where art is, you know, what become the art centers, or where people, where really productive and constructive conversations around art take place, there are, you know, the fact that London is more open than New York, I think has a really big effect on developments. So, I mean, Sharjah is a little bit different than the other parts of the UAE in that the Sheikh is an academic, he writes histories, he writes plays, his daughter studied at the Slade, she has an MA in curating from the Royal College. So it's much more grounded in the art world, and also she speaks Japanese. So it was really great working with Yuko Hasegawa, who is a really prominent and extraordinary curator from Tokyo. So her biennial was huge and was the first time that we used our new art spaces. Previously, we just used sort of old buildings and wings of the museum. But in a way that I don't think you'd see in other biennials, most of the work was, again, a lot of the work was Chinese, or Asian, or Middle Eastern. This is Liu Wei, and a really beautiful installation. This will be familiar to some people. It's a work by an artist named Wael Shawky, who's an Egyptian artist. Wael came out to Sharjah during the 2010 biennial on part of what we call the Witness Program. The Witness Program was a residency where we invited two artists to come out and witness the biennial and then to create some kind of response to it. We worked with Visiting Arts at that time. And it was, Wael was not that well known at that time. Anyway, his idea, he came up with this idea to take all the curatorial texts. You know, the curators that year were Suzanne Cotter, who's British, and Rasha Salty, who's Palestinian. And so he wanted to take the curatorial texts and translate them into the language of the people who work for the foundation doing the installation. So a lot of people who are Iranian or from India or Pakistan, and so the languages were, it ended up being mostly Pakistanis who ended up participating in this, but we did the translation, and they selected the words within those texts that were meaningful to them. So they selected the words, and then they worked with a lyricist to make a song. And the song was then turned into music, and then it was performed at the next biennial. So what you see here, it was performed for 3 days. What you see here is the performance, which he says will never happen again. So the work now lives as a sound piece. There was quite a beautiful show at the Listen Gallery. Last year, was it, Nicholas? Yeah. He's really one of my favorite artists. I really love his work, and I love what he did with this, because it was really about exploring what we think about art and what it means to the people who are not necessarily the normal art audience. But it also is something that work came out of something that was a residency. You know, it was a small project, and it resulted in a really magnificent, really moving work. And so when we look at things like these great big exhibitions, these huge, expansive extravaganzas, you also have to think then, if you're an institution, or if you're working with artists, where do you have the most impact? Where can you have the most, you know, for us it's not an economic result, but how can you create things that actually move people? And, you know, sometimes, as I said earlier, I think some of these big events and big extravaganzas where you take, you know, a bunch of Middle Eastern artists and throw them into London, is that as effective as maybe doing small works, creating opportunities for people to talk to each other that result in other things? It's a question that I have as someone who's worked in the art world for a long time. This is another quite interesting work that was developed over time by a group called CAMP. It's a collective. Their first work was in the 2010 biennial, where it was called Wharfage. They did a book that collected the manifests of all the small boats going in and out of the Sharjah Harbor, and a lot of it's kind of illegal trade between Iran and different places where, you know, it's not, there's these boats and you see them and they're covered with, you know, old cars and sofas, for example, or boxes and boxes of toothbrushes. It's this really low-grade kind of trade that's very visible, and a lot of it is illegal. And so they did that, and they made a radio station down by the port. So they made friends with a lot of these people. The next year, they gave the workers cameras, or not the workers, the sailors, cameras. And they took the cameras on their voyages, and then they made a film by editing all of this footage that these other people had taken. And so then during the 2013 biennial, we screened it next to the souk by the port. So every night, that would be screened after about 8 o'clock, every night you'd have all the sailors coming from the port and the people in the local neighborhood coming and watching this film. CAMP is really involved now with something that's called Gulf Labor, which I don't know if you know about, but it's an organization of artists who are protesting the conditions of the workers who are building Saadiyat Island museums. It's a whole big thing. They have a big thing in Venice where they protest constantly at the Guggenheim in New York. They protested during the biennial at the Peggy Guggenheim. We had invited one of the people to speak at our March meeting in March, and he wasn't given a visa, and another artist who was coming in was sent back from the airport. It's for those of you who aren't aware, it's a very, very big issue. They're in Venice now doing projects. But it also speaks to this thing within the art world, which kind of counteracts the market-based, the market the sort of power of the market, there seems to be increasingly artists who are actually saying, you know, we're not going to engage with that. We're not going to be part of that. And they're looking at things like, you know, what are the conditions of the people who are creating the places where we are supposed to show our art? There are a lot of artists who will not sell their work to the Guggenheim now. They're hoping to create change. Who really knows what will happen? But it's an interesting change, and it also is reflected in the Venice Biennale this year as well. So it goes speaks also to that whole, you know, less than half of the people are from North America and Europe. So it's addressing some of the issues that the art world is not typically addressed. This is another work from that biennial by a collective called Superflex, a Danish architectural collective. They went around the neighborhood and asked people who lived there what was their favorite public furniture and what would they like to see in their neighborhood in Sharjah. So you had a whole mix of all sorts of different playground equipment that was manufactured from around the world, but really reflected the people who lived there. And we actually, it was incredibly popular, and we left it for an extra year, actually, which doesn't usually happen. It's no longer there, though. So this year, the biennial was curated by Eunji Ju, who is an American curator of Korean descent. She, of course, had a completely different perspective as well on what she wanted to do. She invited artists to come out and stay in Sharjah for considerable periods of time to think about what they wanted to make. This is a work by Rupert Tiravanja titled Eau de Rose of Damascus. So it was a garden, a rose garden, and a rose distillery. I don't know if you know the artist, he's always very involved with quite participatory artworks, often food. He'll do things where he cooks for people, or this was about the process of distilling roses and rose perfume. He served rose water lemonade and cookies and had a beautiful little lounge area where you could sit and talk. So it was about exchanging ideas and about being together. Hei Guyen, this is called An Opaque Wind, a site-specific installation. So there were a lot of Korean artists. There were only 50 artists in the exhibition, but most of them were, most of them were not from North America or Western Europe. So again, the idea of talking and communicating and dealing with places instead of just coming in. A lot of biennials, the artists just come in at the last minute to install their works. So you have a kind of lack of engagement, and that was really different about this biennial. It was really about engagement with the place, engagement with the people, and engagement with the ideas. It had a very different kind of atmosphere, a different kind of feeling. A lot of the artists have talked about how for them it was so important to be able to exchange ideas with each other over time. So again, that idea of being able to have the time to develop ideas, to be able to have time to, you know, create engagement with the places that you are. So rather than just having an exhibition that you have no connection to, come into a place and then be gone, you know, the idea of trying to put more of a long-term, more organic sense about the art, where people actually have a chance to talk to the artists. They have a chance to engage with the work. This year we also did it for 3 months instead of two, which was great. We had many more school groups. So that was a really, it had a very, very different feel from other biennials. This is a picture from one of our March meetings. I said we have a regular annual conference where we try to gather people from the region to discuss things that are important to maybe delve into one specific area. This is from 2012, where we it was titled Working with Artists and Audiences on Residencies and Commissions, because we recognized that in the absence of a lot of large institutions across the region, What ended up happening is that people were working on the basis of getting an artist to come in and do something new, or getting an artist to come in and be in residence and do something new, or do education programs. You know, when you don't have big museums, or you don't have funding to do big events, which is really true across most of the Middle East, how do you work with, how do you provide some kind of a service to your communities? How do you help create culture in the place that you are? So that was, for example, what we did for that year. We also like to work a lot with long-term with artists who are developing new ideas. So this is a Sharjah version of a project that the Lebanese sound artist Tariq Atoui began developing many years ago. He worked with us on education programs and developed, you know, music programs for deaf students or programs for people with disabilities, or he had a troubled youth. You know, he worked with people in Paris, say, where they were youths who were from some of the really bad Arab neighborhoods, you know, and tried to get them engaged in projects. But he's also a composer and likes to work with lots of different musicians, and he did, we helped co-fund his project La Suite, which was premiered at Performa, and then Revisiting Tarab, and then this was Revisiting Tarab, which happened in Sharjah. Then he did a version at the Serpentine called The Suite, so we helped fund that. So what happens then is, over time, an artist is able to develop an idea and then to present it in different places around the world with already, you know, you're able to allow an artist to build a kind of momentum in a body of work, which, again, you know, is it better to do that than to do one-off event or to help fund things and help people develop over time? Here's another work by Wael Shoki. So after doing the exhibition, showing his piece in the biennial, we did a small solo exhibition of his work. We also helped co-fund a film he did with the Vienna Festival. But our constituency, we think a lot about who the constituency is that we work in, and there's a lot of Indians and Pakistanis in our area. And we did a solo show by Rashid Areen, who is a Pakistani artist who's been based in London for many years, but whose career has been sort of lost. So it was kind of great that we did this show, and it's like his career has been, again, showcased. He's getting a lot of attention. We're doing another publication. Publications are also things that are really important for institutions to support and to allow resources for people to study and research what's going on. And it's what I mentioned earlier, so I was having a really hard time finding resources, and it's a big problem across the Middle East. So again, you know, every time someone does some exhibition, they should really make sure to do some kind of a major publication that is accessible to people. In this current biennial also, I guess these all got out of order, this is The Incidental Insurgents by Palestinian artists Basel Abbas and Rahan Abu Rameh. They did a three-part video. They won the biennial prize. And here's a work by Tara Shinoda. It was a site-specific work with, in the center, I don't know if you can see it, just barely, there's a sunken hole with the sand going to slowly, 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 imperceptibly disappeared. So if you didn't know it was going to happen, you'd be sitting there watching and you'd see the sand moving slightly, so each day it would be replaced. But it was so poetic and so elegant. And that's in one of the old courtyard buildings. Also in this biennial was Mixed Rice. This is called One Buries Wrinkles and Unearths Memories. It was a video and series of photographs. As a Lebanese artist, Rehan Tabit. And this is called Cypress. This is an artist who often works, his works often tell stories. He did a beautiful work in the Biennial in 2009 where he talked about, he did a research about the Sharjah Cricket Stadium, which is the, it's a long story, but it was a fantastic work about what this cricket stadium meant to people across the Asia. And this work was about a journey that his father tried to take with them to leave Beirut before the last war. And they got out, they bought this boat, they got out in the harbor, and they were all, and this is true. And the father realized the waves were too high. They were going to escape to a better world, and they had to go back and go back to shore. And many years later, after they returned to Beirut, his mother saw the same boat on the shore, and he bought it and just turned it into an artwork. So, this is a Jordanian artist, Farnes Ziad, who's, this is a collection of works. They belong to the collection of Prince Rad bin Zayed. And so here's an example of an artist whose work, she's now deceased, but the sort of modernist nature, which of course nobody really knows about because there's no documentation and there's no art, very little published about her work. So again, this was an opportunity for people to discover. Nikhil Chopra, who did an Indian artist, who did a performance work, a really fantastic performance work called Use Like Water. It was one of the highlights of the biennial. And so I suppose, in this rather wandering kind of way, I guess I'd like to, I've been asking myself, what is it that really works in this kind of international cultural exchange? You know, how can you think about what is actually good to do? How should you spend your energies? What should we be supporting when institutions do things? Because we all have ways that we support or we encourage or we observe or take part in. I've really gone off huge, big, extravagant touring international exhibitions of, you know, that place artists from one place as a kind of spectacle. I'm not sure I believe that even things that I've worked on in the past have been very successful. You know, you look back and you see all these exhibitions and all these projects you work on and how few of those artists actually benefited from the expense and the energy. I think the smaller projects, the personal exchanges, the supporting artists to go somewhere, to meet somebody, to talk, to develop a new project, residencies I think are fantastic. I think supporting publications is really a productive way to help create some kind of legacy. Again, you know, do these big exhibitions. I mean, how many exhibitions of Japanese art in London do you remember? How many big exhibitions of Middle Eastern art have you seen and thought, wow, that was actually really fantastic and it taught me a lot? I mean, people here, they tend to remember the show at Saatchi, which was, what was the title? Anybody remember? The one of his collection. It was all very cliched, you know, all about veils and conflict and, you know, all these things that are kind of cliches. So I suppose that for myself, I think, you know, actually, it was interesting. Melissa Chu was quoted in an article talking about what did she think were the influences that were most important for artists in China. And her response was that artists who studied abroad coming back, the rise of independent artist-run initiatives, and the spread of the kind of international and regional biennials and events, because they all allowed conversations and person-to-person exchange. So maybe the biennials things are more important because of the connections that people make to each other and the opportunities they provide people. And I have to say, in Sharjah, you know, we have all of these things, you know, every biennial, the things that end up feeling the best are when people meet each other and something else comes out of that. You know, that when you see that actually for example, we don't sell art, but we're really happy when really big collectors come and maybe they commission new work from an artist who would never have had that exposure before. So for example, there's a collector who has her own foundation, Nicoletta Fiorucci, who came to come to the last three biennials, but you know, I know she has met artists at the biennial and had them produce new works or been involved with her foundation and her events in Stromboli. And it can be a really good and really productive engagement that people have. So I'm really for the person-to-person, you know, getting people there and getting people to be part of the conversation. So that's one thing that I've really decided I think is important. You know, there's a whole discussion and, you know, people talk about what's changed over the years. And even 2005, Fries did a survey asking 30-some artists and critics and collectors what they thought about the changes in the art world and what they thought had really changed over the years. And there were a lot of, you know, sort of not that interesting responses, but varied responses. And I thought, you know, Liam Gillick, who is an artist who lives here in New York, said, attention, what has changed, and what he said was, attention that results from a skepticism about globalization that is constantly confronted by a desire to continue a form of developed internationalism. A repositioning of the critical voice in light of the rise of curating as a semi-autonomous set of critical structures, shifts in established social hierarchies in light of the challenges of varied politics of identity, the repeated and ongoing exposure of institutional frameworks within a cultural and broader social context, and the ongoing reoccupation of cultural and social space as soon as it is abandoned as inconvenient by the dominant culture. I think what he's noting is how, you know, we have, there's this conflict between the damage that too much globalization does, but yet the necessity to find a way to be international and to engage with the international without doing that in the wrong way. Nobody really knows how to do it right. I don't really feel that it's that easy of a thing in the West, for example, to actually properly engage on a large scale. Look at the institutions and the collections. It's still a struggle for any major institution to be collecting regional contemporary art. It's led to the development of a number of, say, for example, Tate develops acquisitions committees for, say, you've got the American Acquisitions Committee, the Latin American Acquisitions Committee, the Middle Eastern Acquisitions Committee. I think there's now a South Asian Acquisitions Committee. But these are ways to help fund the acquisitions, but also to fund the institutions. So it's not necessarily that all the money goes straight into acquiring art. But it does allow the curators to travel. And one of the good things they do is they do take their people around to different places. So over time, that will also have an effect. The fact that the Tate members groups travel around the world, what do they come back with besides some art that they buy at the art fairs? I think a lot of them do come back with an interest in supporting some of the art that they have seen in these other places. So I don't have a really important conclusion. I guess I just am kind of sharing the things that I've seen over the years, in some ways how little we've advanced, how far we haven't gotten. And, you know, to recognize that there's still issues of how we represent what is other and, you know, the art that's from elsewhere. In spite of that and all of those issues, I would say that for me personally, I think it remains really clear that art is a really important and powerful means to inform and engage people and to connect us across the world. And I wish we could get it right and get it better and do it more efficiently and with more effect, but I think everybody, it's important to recognize that it is an important endeavor and that it does have some effect. So thank you.
This year is to bring young artists from our summer exhibition. I hardly know any of them anyway. I've done together about painting a conversation about who should come, probably four or five of them, and bring two or three artists from Kenya, Nairobi, or maybe one or two other places in Africa, not too complicated, of the same generation, so that they can hang out together and maybe make some more, see what happens.
Yeah.
And that's going to be productive because they will both remember and I don't think that it's such a fair deal for the London-based artists going to Kenya because they're not likely to be offered exhibitions in Nairobi or wherever, or Kampala, whereas the African artists might, if they bond with the British artists, they are the British.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's...
They will get a platform in London.
That's a really important kind of initiative. I mean, I know that, for example, at the March meeting where in 2012, James Lingwood, for example, came out and was able to meet people there who he would not have met otherwise. Like the Sudan film, it was James Lingwood, Jude Kelly, and a lot of people who had never ever been, you know, main people who are part of major institutions had never been out to the Middle East. So that's something that, you know, you have to also do is we paid their airfare to come out and speak and gave them the opportunity to meet people like the young people at Sudan Film Factory or that, you know, so you've also got a situation where you've got these major institutional heads who maybe don't have a reason or maybe they're not organizing, maybe they're not doing that thing where we have to organize a Middle East show. So they don't necessarily go out, they don't have the opportunity, they're busy, they're too much travel already. But that's also an important thing to do is to bring people like those artists out somewhere else where they might not have been before to not only give the young people or people who don't know them a chance to meet, but also to give them a chance to like wake up and to have a different experience. Because
it's a culture shock.
Yeah, culture shock.
A couple of things. First, I was so pleased to see Rashida Rehin. Rashida Rehin was one of the great warriors in the early days of fighting for exhibitions of different cultures around the world. And to see that he was recognized at Sharjah was very helpful to him personally. Extraordinary change for his life. Yeah. And I helped other galleries and show his work. So
yeah, so it's
just, that's one way you can really complement that public showing, which is
it's
very
one thing.
Important. And then the commercial galleries then take.
Well, also we're going to do a monograph of his work. So you know, I think that what we have to. You know, it's important to think not just about doing that one thing and then it's done. You've done that Middle Eastern show or you've done that Japan show, tick the box, you know, but you think about ways to have things that have some kind of a resonance, different kinds of influences. And I don't think in the art world we do that enough. I think people get so busy, you know, underfunded, busy, way too much going on, way too much travel, everybody's exhausted and jet lagged. So you get the project done. And you're struggling so hard just to actually get it finished that you forget about what you should do with what the outcomes are and how you can make it more important and what more you can do. And that's something I've been thinking about a lot.
Anyone else? Yes?
I have visited an exhibition in Sharjah, and the question when I went through the various displays, there wasn't much of the Middle East expression in there. They were, the paintings or displays were from all over Southeastern Europe, India, Pakistan, Afghanistan. But there wasn't much display of the Middle Eastern life over there.
What exhibition was that?
I don't remember that. It was about 3-4 years ago. I was visiting there and came across this exhibition. So that's what I noticed. My question is, how to have a feel of nationality in international atmosphere? Like Sharjah is providing a stage for all the exhibition which you set. But where is the life of UAE over there?
You mean what do we do with the UAE artists?
I mean to say the art of UAE.
Well, I mean that's this
the life
is.
Of UAE.
I mean, this is slightly a problem for me, for example, and for us as an organization. I mean, the UAE, the actual population of the UAE that is Emirati national is like less than 20%.
Yes.
It's less than 20%.
Yep.
And it's a young country, and there hasn't been a huge amount of art education. There is a certain amount, but you don't have mass. If you were going to do regularly exhibitions that just focused on Emirati art, you'd be doing a lot of really bad exhibitions because there's just not that many, you know. And I think that it's a mistake to sort of privilege the nationality over the quality of the work in terms of making a curatorial selection for a show or prioritizing what you as an institution do. We feel it's very important for us to help support the development of young artists, and we do regular exhibitions for not just Emiratis, but people who live in the UAE. For example, we have something called Vantage Point Sharjah every year, which is an open call exhibition of photography. Anybody can submit. Anyone who is a resident in the UAE can submit photographs for, you know, this year it's the theme of landscape, or still life, I'm sorry. So, you know, do we say, oh, this is just for Emiratis? No, I don't think that's right. But there have been initiatives within the UAE that have done that, and it's really bad for the artists because you get all of these young artists who aren't very good, who all of a sudden are given huge exposure that would take years and years and years and years for any other artist anywhere else to get that kind of exposure. And so all of a sudden, they don't have to work anymore. They can do anything, and they just churn out stuff that isn't very important. Now, I think there's a recognition that that's a problem. People like the Sheikh Salama Foundation have started a program to encourage postgraduate studies in the arts. And so what they're doing is they're working with RISD. They're bringing people out, you know, because it's so non-competitive in the art schools. I mean, they're okay, some of the art schools, but it's not super competitive. And art is not seen as a career that is a respected career. So whether it's as an artist or as an art professional working in the art world, parents don't encourage their children to do that. I think that a number of different bodies within the UAE have recognized that there needs to be a different approach. So, for example, as I said, the Sheikh Islam Foundation is taking students, I've been asked to contribute names of people who've been out of school for 3 years as an undergraduate who've worked. And they are given bursaries to do this special RISD graduate program where a year is in the UAE, and then if they pass that year, they get to go study at RISD. Now, I mean, that's an incredible opportunity for people. But because there hasn't been that degree of education as yet, it's still, you know, it's quite difficult. There are some good artists. Chika Kourakasemi curated the UAE Pavilion this year in Venice, and they did a historical review of exhibitions. So it was very much history of how the art world developed in the UAE. But half the artists are not Emirati, native Emiratis. They're people who lived there that were part of the Emirates Fine Arts Society. But, you know, that is the problem. It is a dilemma for people.
It's good that we have this dialogue. And Asia House, for me, is a place where I'm very fortunate colleagues like to come and share these issues, because it is open still to thinking about breaking out these borders and border lines. So please, can we just give them a very big hand?